Today, I have a special guest as Dr. Jim Garlow joins me to talk about the benefits of humor. I think it is safe to say that currently stress abounds. I mean, can I light off a fireworks without offending someone? If I go out and buy groceries without a mask, will I be killing more people than Hannibal Lecter? And most importantly, when will football be back on? Oh yeah, I get it. The Kansas City Chiefs finally get a franchise Super Bowl winning quarterback, and then football ends. So with all of this stress, we need to pause and enjoy life. And a best-selling author and confidant to kings, queens, and sometimes his grandkids, Dr. Jim Garlow will join us today to unpack the benefits of humor, all of this in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Before we get to my interview with Dr. Garlow, I have to play for you the funniest clip I have ever heard in my life. So during this interview, Dr. Garlow referenced this roasting he did of Jack Hafer, and it is hilarious. I had tears in my eyes. I'm still laughing, so I don't want to spoil it for you. And so without any further ado, let's hear this roast of Dr.
I don't know if this has happened to you, but have you noticed something, pastors, as you've been at this conference these last couple days, have you noticed that after being under the anointed teaching of Pastor Jack Hafer for 3 days, that in just casual conversation with one another, you start speaking in much longer sentences? With very complex grammatical structure. To our brother Hafer, the word you see, sentence and paragraph, are synonymous terms. He is so anointed, and his grammatical construction is so complex, I found myself saying amen to sentences I did not understand. And he's a prolific writer, cranking out one book after another. I had a dream last night that he wrote a new 200-page book, and the entire thing was one sentence. And then vocabulary words that none of us have heard, but we all go, oh, yes, oh, yeah. I looked around me on the first night to see if I was the only one who wasn't understanding what was being said. All right, now, these are my notes, literally my notes from the first night, Monday night. How many here Monday night? And we talked, this one part, six things which blur the shepherd's focus. Six things. The fifth one, and if you look at your notes, you'll find this. You'll remember, it was on the overhead. Preening over contemporaneity. Waiting for an interpretation. What else is a Nazarene to do when he was among Pentecostals? And I turned to my wife and I said, honey, am I a preener? She says, if Brother Jack says it's wrong, you repent of it. So sitting right here in the quietness of my heart, I said, oh God, I repent of preening. What's preening?
Well, welcome to today's podcast, Debriefing the Law. I am Joel Oster, and today I have a very special guest. I have today Dr. Jim Garlow. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He's written such books as Cracking the Da Vinci Code. Now, I'm still waiting for the movie version of this book. Jim, I want to see who will play you in this movie. If you'll be butting heads with Tom Hanks, I'm thinking maybe Tim Allen might be a good call. You might be thinking Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise might be a better fit. Nonetheless, I'm excited to see who might play you in the movie. Well, you recently wrote and released God Will See You Through This. Now, I am assuming you had no idea when you were writing this book that it would be released while the world was in a turmoil with viruses and riots. But very timely, to say the least. And I believe you wrote 750,000 other books. I am not sure. You are as well-written as you are well-spoken. Speaking of well, you also wrote well-versed and have a well-versed podcast. You were the pastor of Skyline Wesleyan Church for San Diego for 20 years. I probably could fill up the rest of the hour talking about how amazing you are. But to say it, to kind of put it succinctly, you are a religious expert, legal expert, best-selling author, pastor extraordinaire, world traveler. You meet with kings and queens and presidents. So I say, to say I'm excited about this chance to talk to you today would be a vast understatement. So, Jim, thank you. Welcome, and thank you for being on today.
Just keep the introduction going. I'm enjoying this. Keep talking. I want my kids to hear this.
That's right. It's all being recorded. But Dr. Garlow, you have to know, if a person is going to invite someone onto their podcast, that person is obligated to do some research. You know that, right?
I have heard that, yes.
And yet you've agreed to come on this show, and that's very brave of you, because I did some digging. Now, listeners, you have to understand, Jim's family and my family go back all the way to Central Kansas, Miltonville, Clay Center. I believe your older sister, Judy, was in my parents' wedding, and they were roommates at nursing college together. Is that right?
Your mother and my sister, they were roommates in nurses training. That's correct.
Wow. Okay. So we go way back. So you know I have access to information. So I asked my aunt and uncle, Sharon Buttermore, used to be Sharon Mackey, and Dwayne Buttermore, used to be Dwayne Buttermore, if they could tell me any stories.
And let
me tell you, Aunt Sharon was very quick to respond.
Her dad was my Greek professor, by the way.
Really? Okay, back there in college in Miltonville?
Yes, uh-huh.
All right, well, she said, and I quote, "Jim was quite the ladies' man. I remember one of Valentine's when I ran into him at the local Jones Sundries in Miltonville, Kansas. He was trying to pick out the perfect box of heart-shaped candy. In a bit of frustration, he turned to me and said, 'If you only knew how many of these things I've bought.'" So is that a true story?
I don't know about that.
I tell you what, she was quick to the trigger there. Apparently, you must be very happy that social media did not exist during your formative years, but those were just some of the stories. So it is really great to have you on.
Now, your mother and her family lived in that little town of Miltonville. I can see exactly what the house looked like on the corner there.
Okay, I've been to that house.
They called it Miltonville. Population, 600?
Okay.
They called it Miltonville. It was named after Milton Toodle. They
really?
Picked his first name, Milton, because they didn't want to call it Toodleville.
I can understand that. That doesn't make a lot of sense, I guess.
That's a true story.
Really?
Toodle Park, when you come into Miltonville and you make that big winding curve to the right when you come in from Highway 24, that park right there where the band shell is and the athletic field, that's called Toodle Park. But they didn't want to call the town Toodleville.
No, that makes sense. Now, you're from Clay Center, though, right?
No, you got the wrong direction. You went east. If you go due north, Clay Center's a big town of a couple thousand.
I'm
from Ames, Kansas.
Ames.
Population 50. Well, I'm 3 miles from Ames, Kansas. And then 3 miles, the other side is Rice, Kansas, population 8.
Wow.
Which is 6 miles north of Hoosier, which had a population of 3 until Ralph died. And Julie went to college.
Wow.
And so it was down to one person in Hoosier, Kansas. Actual truth.
I remember wonderful those, people. I remember those days traveling through rural Nebraska. We went through a town called Arthur, Nebraska, population 6. And it dawned on me as we were driving through, we doubled that population size just by driving through in our car.
Yeah. These were great towns with great, wonderful people. And the farm community, I love the people, love the life, and love everything about North Central Kansas.
Hey, in today's day and age.
But I live in San Diego, right near the ocean. And I'm very happy to be here where it's sunny and 70 degrees every day.
Wow. I have got to stop doing these interviews remotely. A couple weeks ago, I interviewed Alicia Rushton. She was calling me from the beaches in Hawaii, in Maui, and you're in San Diego. And yeah, I am definitely losing out on these interviews. But, well, so Dr. Garlow, I want to give you a test. Now, don't worry. If you don't know the answer to this, I will delete this portion from the podcast. So no worries there. But, you know, I have you on, and you have all kinds of degrees in theology and in history. And so I want to, I have a serious question for you here. All right. Do you know who Jesus reserved his harshest words for?
Well, I would assume the religious leaders, the Pharisees, but I have a feeling I'm being set up and I've just given a wrong answer.
Well, again, you are a history major, and are you all kinds of degrees in history and religion. You're definitely a partly right. I've gone through your 750,000 books. By the way, you need more pictures there, but I haven't seen you address this issue specifically. I'm hoping maybe in one of your future books you can cover it, but Jesus, he reserved his harshest words for the lawyers. Would you not agree with me? Were not the Pharisees and Sadducees the legal experts of that day?
Jesus is the Son of God, and if he picked on the attorneys, he's right.
He's right. I'm going to tell you what. You know what? That means, yes, even Jesus enjoyed a good lawyer joke. I have no idea what jokes those would be, but doesn't the New Testament say somewhere there were a lot of other things that Jesus said and did that were not reported? Maybe those were where they recorded the lawyer jokes. I am not sure.
But John wrote that.
Oh, John wrote that. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, he can't give us any love. But that's why I have you on here. Now, surely there is a theological significance to that somewhere, that Jesus reserved his harshest words for the Pharisees and Sadducees, who were the legal experts of the day. Do you have any idea on why he did reserve his harshest words for that group of people? I need some validation for my career calling.
They were the fastest to articulate what they thought was the letter of the law and missed and distorted the entire spirit and intent of the law.
Wow, good. I like that answer. I like that answer. They misread. In other words, they were perverting the letter of the law, using it for bad to bring about harm. And that's exactly my take. My take is Jesus came to actually kind of shed some light as to the true purpose of the law, which is it's kind of our excuse to love one another. We can use.
He came to fulfill it. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Say, look, this is, he told the story of David and his companions. Didn't you remember David and his companions when they were going through on the Sabbath, they ate bread consecrated for the priests. And so he told that story. But here's another theological question for you, slightly more serious, but, you know, still I'm just trying to take advantage of this opportunity of having an expert in religion. But it is my contention, with little to no foundation except for being alive for half a century and observing the world around me, that humans like to laugh. I think my dog likes to laugh as well, but the verdict is still out on that one. It's also possible she just wants more treats. But I will go even further than that. I think that we prefer to be in a state of laughter. All things being equal, we would rather laugh than not laugh. And you can substitute joy in here if you would like. And I personally believe we were created in God's image, which means, ergo, God likes to laugh as well. Is this true, or should I be worried about a lightning bolt coming from the sky and I should be, like, taking cover here? Am I onto something about, since we are created in God's image, God also likes to laugh?
I once spoke for the National Association of Christian Comedians.
Really?
I don't know if you knew there was such an organization.
Did not know.
I spoke to them. I think the total number, I was going to say 300, but I don't. I may be way off in my number, but I think they had that many people weren't there at the time, but right. I think they had a membership or something like that. At least there was a good number of them. And I based my talk to them on a passage that they knew well, Proverbs 17:22. One version says a happy heart is like good medicine.
Okay.
But a broken spirit drains your strength. Another translation says it this way, Proverbs 17:22, a cheerful heart makes you healthy.
Okay.
Now, what is that saying? And what I said to them that day, I said, you see yourself as comedians.
Right.
You're not. You're healers.
Ah.
A cheerful heart makes one healthy. And I said, right now, this was a number of years ago, right now, I said, my wife is battling cancer.
Right.
She went through a 6-year battle with cancer. My first wife died about 7 years ago. And so I said, you're the bringers of medicine, a unique kind of medicine. I said, there's across the border from San Diego in Tijuana, Mexico, is a wonderful place called Oasis of Hope Hospital.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot of bogus treatments in Mexico, but there's some also wonderful and good ones and legitimate ones. And one of those wonderful, legitimate places is called Oasis of Hope. When we go there, we have a multi-pronged program. It's not just chemo. It's not just radiation. It's not just surgery. They can do all that.
Right.
It's not just the healthy nutrition. They do that. It's not just the positive mindset, because they insist people to continue to be in street clothes rather than hospital gowns.
Okay.
It's not just the positive attitude that when you go to the cafeteria, you're required to think you can only share positive news when you're in that cafeteria eating with other people. The bedrooms are all designed. The rooms are all designed so that you have your spouse with you. So it's a place of companionship.
Okay.
Enjoy and delight. But they have a laughter department.
Really?
And I'm asking you, as Christian comedians, to give me, each of you, this is back in the days of the DVDs.
Right, right.
Give me one copy of each one of your, or maybe these were even, I can't remember what the medium was back then. I said, give me a copy of your humor. I want to take them there, and I want you to help heal patients who are battling with cancer.
Fascinating.
And they had a person on staff who was in charge of laughter. And they would gather, I don't think it was every night, but maybe 2 or 3 times a week. You'd gather in this room. This lady would get you laughing hard.
Right, right.
And she would play videotapes and this kind of thing. Because that there was a man in Hollywood, a well-known figure years ago, who when he found out he had cancer, literally watched humorous videos all day long.
Interesting.
And he contended that actually brought healing to his diseased body. Pretty strong statement to make, but it certainly helps produce health. There's something physiological that occurs in laughter that is good. The medical people can tell you what that is. I'm not able to.
Right,
but
right.
Something about laughter is a very good, healthy thing.
Yeah,
the body.
I'm not sure we fully understood what that means from a medical standpoint or even a theological standpoint, that we all are drawn to laughter. We love it. We crave it. I give this example in my class. So I teach this class called Comedy in the Courts, Using Humor to Persuade. It's about how you can use humor to try to break down barriers so that if you're trying to persuade someone to your point, it just helps you achieve that objective. But in doing that study, I'm not sure we really fully understand what it means that we were so we are drawn to humor. But here's one of the tests that I give. Let's say that I had tickets for you this upcoming weekend. I'm pretty sure I know which tickets you're going to take. I have tickets to the front row at a funeral of someone, or front row to a Jerry Seinfeld or a Tim Hawkins concert. Pretty much, I don't care how tasty the potato salad is, all things equal, you'd rather laugh than not laugh. And so I don't know what the full theological ramification from that is, but that's an amazing story that they're using it as a treatment at a hospital there in Mexico.
Let me take you a step further. Elton Trueblood, the late, great Elton Trueblood from Earlham College in Richmond, Indiana, one of the most brilliant philosophers and quite a historian, a Quaker scholar, wrote a book many years ago. It's a classic. A classic is any book that's still being read 50 years after you wrote it.
Right, right.
And it's a classic. It's called The Humor of Christ.
Okay, really?
And he says we miss out so much when we read the New Testament. we fail to see the hilarity of the statements that the disciples would just been splitting a gut laughing
right
so hard at what Jesus just said in the Pharisees at the Pharisees' expense. And just think about this. When you turn on the news and you flip on, let's say, Fox News,
right,
and they go to Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, not the famous John Kennedy from Massachusetts right. being president, but Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana. Why do they go to this guy who hasn't been elected all that long when there's 99 other senators?
Right.
It's because what he says is funny.
Interesting.
He's got these one-liners. The Will Rogers sounds like Will Rogers
right, right.
repeat. And you just sit there laughing.
People are drawn to it.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, has this ever happened?
The health.
Has this ever happened to you? It's happened to me. I don't have near as many sermons and experiences as you have, you've had. But I would preach a sermon. And, you know, when you preach a sermon, you spill your heart out, right? You spend all week analyzing it, praying, just trying to figure out what the right words are that God wants you to say. You deliver that sermon, and afterwards, people come up to you, and what do they say? Do they say, oh, thank you for the great insight. Thank you for the spiritual application. No, they say, oh, wow, you're funny. That was a great joke you told, Pastor. Like, all right, well, at least they remember the joke. Hopefully, they remember the point that came after it as well. But, hey, beggars can't be choosers sometimes.
In November of 1992, I was asked to give a talk at Jack Hayford's Pastor's Conference.
Okay.
With several thousand people there. That my talk was a one-hour walk through 2,000 years of church history in 1 hour.
Wow.
And so it was intense.
Okay.
But I started picking some jokes, picking on Jack Hayford.
Okay.
And the crowd just kind of pulled more out of me, and it ended up going for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 minutes maybe.
Right, right.
Or so. But the crowd began roaring so much. That was back in the early days of videotape. They captured that.
Okay.
And it was so popular that first, say, 10 minutes that they started selling it
really?
By itself. And I, to this day, to this very day, have had people who remember me. They say, oh, preening over contemporaneity. It was one of the phrases, one of the jokes on Jack Hayford I told. And I still didn't remember. I started getting churches asked me to come tell jokes at their church. I said,
really?
No, I'm not a joke guy. I'm not.
Oh.
That was just the moment. That was the moment.
Oh, you're so funny.
The power. I'll send you a link to that.
So yes, I was going to ask
watch.
For that.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do.
We'll put that on the show notes here of this podcast. I would love that. That is some great stories. Now, great segue to my next topic, which is well-versed. I mean, it's a book that you wrote recently. This title is an amazing title. How did you come up with the title, Well-Versed?
I wish I could take credit for it. I had another title in mind for years.
Really?
Then when I finally got ready to write this, and my publisher, wonderful publisher, Regnery Publishers, they're located 3 blocks from the U.S. Capitol, they didn't like my title.
Okay.
So they came up with theirs, and I didn't like their title. So we were at a stalemate, and some millennial, I don't know who it is, just said the word well-versed. The guy called me, says, I have got the answer. I thought, yeah, right. I was changing planes at an airport.
Right.
He says, well-versed. I said, that's it.
Wow.
Now jump ahead to 2018. We're launching a new ministry. I pastored Skyline Church for 23 years. I'm stepping aside from that. Now I'm launching the full-time ministry in Washington, D.C., in New York City, at the United Nations, and in Jerusalem with our current ministry. But I didn't have a name for it. I came up with a bunch of names. Talking to a guy on the phone, I said, I can't come up with the right name. He said, all your names that you have are not good. He says, what do you do? He said, I said, well, we make known this contents from this book, Well-Versed. He says, stop.
Right,
what did you
right.
say? My book, Well-Versed. He says, there's your name.
That is
Well-Versed.
That is an amazing name.
I didn't even think it has a double entendre. Obviously, it means to be articulate on the
right.
issue, but Well-Versed, the Bible verses. And so that became the name of our ministry as well as the book I wrote in 2016.
Well, Well-Versed is an amazing title for a book. It does hit it right on the head. And so I like to focus on the crazy laws in this podcast, you know, the wacky legal stories. And I do this for a reason. I think there is freedom in understanding the flawed nature of our laws. You know, it shines a light on our true calling, which is to use the law to love one another, not to justify, you know, our political agenda or whatever we want to do to, you know, bring hurt on someone else. And so you struck, you identified a real crazy law. At least I identified it as a crazy law. The Johnson Amendment. Can you just explain a little bit about the Johnson Amendment and why that plays into your book?
Lyndon Baines Johnson, before he was president, was a senator from Texas. He was in the process of running a senatorial election, and there was two business people. One was in the newspaper business. The other one was an oil tycoon who campaigned against him using their not-for-profit corporations.
Okay.
There's also one preacher involved, but primarily these two businessmen is what irked Johnson. So he got back to Washington, D.C. right as they were doing an overhaul of the tax code. And he added an amendment that was not discussed at all. No public discussion.
Okay.
And passed only on a voice vote, July the 2nd, 1954. What it said, in effect, was that you could, if you had a 501c3 and not-for-profit corporation, you could not endorse or oppose a candidate.
Right.
The IRS immediately seized upon that, began using it as churches to silence them on speaking out in favor or in opposition to a candidate. The chief of staff, the chief legislative aide, for Lyndon Baines Johnson at the time, admitted that we didn't even have churches in mind. We were just angry with these two businessmen.
Yeah.
There was one pastor that was kind of a minor player to him, but they wanted to shut down these two businessmen, and that's the way they saw they could potentially do it. Ironically, of all that, you would know this as an attorney, there's, I think, 29 different categories of 501C, but only one of them, 501C3 of the 29, was selected that it, by the Johnson Amendment, could not, a person could not, in this case a pastor, cannot endorse or oppose a candidate.
Right.
That sounds simple enough until you find out that the IRS could not define what did it mean to endorse or oppose a candidate. So if a pastor said, we should never vote for abortion, the killing of babies in the womb, we should only vote for candidates who support pro-life, the babies in the womb.
Exactly.
If there's two candidates, one's pro-life, one's pro-abortion, is that not, in fact, a de facto support and denunciation of the other candidate? But the attorneys couldn't really get the IRS to ever answer. But they used it as a club to silence people. And from 1954 to the present, unfortunately, not only pastors bought in on the cultural myth with a false understanding of the intentionality of Thomas Jefferson's famous phrase, wall of separation, which got distorted in the Supreme Court in 1947 in the Everson case, separation of church and state got
right.
flipped on its head the opposite way that Thomas Jefferson met. He meant the state cannot come in and control the church. It did not say that the church cannot come in and impact the state, which is really ironic in light of the recent ruling where Chief Justice John Roberts, just this recent week, voted with the liberal four on the on the court
right.
to make a 5-4 majority, in which it was ruled that Governor Gavin Newsom's declaration in California that no church could have more than 100 people in it, either 25% of your of your attendance or 100 people, whichever is less. So a church of 10,000 people can only have 100. That went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Quickly, too. One week.
It went, yep. And at midnight Friday night, it actually got there in about 2 days.
Wow.
I think it was very few days.
Right.
From the Ninth Circuit to the by the time it got to the Supreme Court, Friday night at midnight, John Roberts said it's no violation of the First Amendment. How in the world that's possible? But in other words, the state can have intrusion into the life of the church, which the Constitution is written so that he couldn't. Now, that's what the Johnson Amendment did. So thanks to Alliance Defending Freedom, with approximately 3,000 attorneys, including you, I had the privilege of leading a national campaign to get pastors to intentionally and willfully violate the Johnson Amendment.
Right.
Intentionally endorse or oppose the candidate from the pulpit, record their sermon, mail it to the IRS in hopes that the IRS would sue. And the Alliance Defending Freedom was prepared to send its attorney to defend.
Right.
I don't know the number that actually did that. I think over the years, I think the number might be 4,400, but I'm a little vague. I don't know the number. But quite a number of pastors did mail them in. All we got was cards or letters back from the IRS saying, thank you for your sermons, which with all those good sermons there, you think somebody's getting saved.
Right.
You would hope there's no evidence of that yet. But and all that was mailed in, and they would not take a single church to court.
Right.
Why?
They would not play ball.
And the only reason they can possibly give is they knew they would lose in court, because what they were doing by the Johnson Amendment was in violation of the Constitution. And why I'm slowing down right here is you would know this, Joel, above anybody, but every one of your listeners who've bought into the myth of separation of church and state, it's not in the Declaration of Independence,
our
founding document, our birth certificate, so to speak. It's not in the U.S. Constitution anywhere. It was only a phrase that was borrowed and manipulated, written by Thomas Jefferson, wrote the phrase wall of separation to the Danbury Baptist January the 1st, 1802.
Right.
And he meant that the government could not intrude into the life of the church at all. And even Supreme Court justices said, we cannot tax the church because whatever you tax, you can control, you can kill.
Yeah, you can destroy it.
We have no authority over the church at all.
Right.
Therefore, along comes the Johnson Amendment, which is a complete violation of the Constitution. But we have never been able to prove it because we can't get them to court. The only way, oftentimes the president will say, President Trump will say, well, I signed an executive order regarding the Johnson Amendment. Well, he did. I was in the Rose Garden when he did that.
Right.
In May of 2017. But in reality, what happened, it's not overturned. It can only be overturned by the U.S. Congress. We came very close to doing that, right on the edge of being able to do it. And some parliamentarian ruled that that part of the legislation had to be thrown out.
Really?
Some unknown character. Yes. Right on the edge of a victory. And it was snatched from us by some unknown who arbitrarily said, no, you can't have that in the legislation. Bizarre.
Wow.
Some of my congressman friends were so disappointed. So we're still in this battle. And unfortunately, pastors have bought into that myth. Here's an amazing bit of statistics, Joel. 90% of pastors, according to George Barna, who's a very close buddy of mine, I was with him before he released what I'm about to say.
Okay.
And I could see how troubled he was by this. I was with him up in San Francisco in 2013 before he released this, and unfortunately, the stats probably have not changed much since then. 90% of pastors agree that the Bible speaks to the cultural, political, and social issues of our day.
Right.
But when asked in that same survey, will you speak out on what the Bible speaks out on the cultural, social, and political issues of our day? 90% said no, they would not.
Interesting.
Now, 2 years later, in 2015, he's now interviewing the people in the pew. And the people in the pew identified 22 topics that they wanted their preachers to speak about, social, political, cultural issues, that they wanted to know what does the Bible have to say about it. At the end of the survey, they were asked, will you speak out on the issues? And laymen said no. And the reason I thought they were going to give is because they'd be afraid of being called names, intolerant, homophobic, Islamophobic, transphobic, whatever phobic is the buzzword of the day. And that's not what they said. They said, we do not speak out on the issues because we do not know what to say.
Interesting.
When I read those words, I put together a team to help me research, and we wrote the book in a relatively short span of time called Well-Versed, where we lay out the biblical foundations of 30 political topics: taxation, minimum wage, Social Security, healthcare, welfare, of course, abortion, marriage, is there such thing as a just war, et cetera, all these topics to help people understand the scriptural foundations to civil governance.
Which makes sense. I mean, I recently, I love to smoke. I am an avid smoker. Of course, you know I'm from Kansas City. I'm talking about smoking barbecue. And so I love to smoke barbecue. And I bought a Pit Boss smoker, and it broke down. It wouldn't work. And so do you know who I called? Pit Boss, because I wanted them to tell me how to fix my Pit Boss smoker, because they're the ones that created it. And so I love the context of your assignment there. It's like, well, we believe that God created mankind, creator of the world, kind of knows something about how this world can operate to the highest efficiency. And so you are basically going right to the source to try to figure out what God has to say about these various issues.
Almost everybody understands that the Bible speaks to their personal private lives.
Okay.
They understand it speaks to their family life. They understand it speaks to their congregational and church life. But the average Christian does not understand that the Bible speaks to issues of civil governance.
Right.
God is so good, and he's so smart. He's smart, and I'm not. He's smarter than me.
Right.
And God is the one who designed government, and he establishes nations. Now, if God designed government, Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, the government's on the shoulder of the Messiah. If God established government, and he establishes nations, would he be so haphazard to say, we're going to need to have government, and we're going to have nations, but I just don't have anything to think about how they run.
Right, I'm not going to tell you anyways, right? I'm going to keep my secret. All right, thanks so much.
And blessings on you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a mess. Our marketing team of Redbird Solutions and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.